Hello, I'm Barbara Peters, and I'm at the Poison Pen on February the 5th with Andrew Grant, who has been with us several times before. In fact, I think for all of your books.
I think so, yeah. This is the eighth time, I believe.
Right.
Yeah.
And here you are, wifeless.
I am. It's a bit like sleepless in Seattle. It should be wifeless in, doesn't quite work, does it? Wifeless in Scottsdale.
But doesn't have the same ring.
Not quite. No.
Well, we're sorry that Tasha is not with us, but happily we saw her in the fall when she had her new book out. And you were here to talk to us about Invisible, which really is an interesting concept that you told us about when we were visiting you last May. Mm-hmm. What was your inspiration for Invisible?
Well, really, there were two strands of inspiration for the book, when I say book, I'm hoping it's going to turn into a nice long-running series. But the first one was something that's been really with me since I was a kid. When I was young, I used to love things like The Scarlet Pimpernel, you know, stories where you had a hero that risked everything to right wrongs in the world, but without looking for any reward for himself, and also done anonymously. I think there's something really interesting about somebody who is working in the shadows, keeping their identity secret. That kind of tied in with another book I really liked when I was younger. It's a long time since I've read it, so I'll probably get the details wrong, but I really was taken by The Castle by Franz Kafka, where you had this really strange, surreal world where no one knew what was going on. The town was governed by people in the castle, and no one knew what was happening, except it turned out for one guy, and that guy was the hairdresser. He was the, everybody came, no one talked to each other, but everybody came to him to get their hair cut, and they talked to him, so he knew. And I remember as a teenager being fascinated by this idea that it wasn't about status, it wasn't about your title, it wasn't about where you were born in, you know, what role you were born into in society. It was about this guy that had a regular job who was the only one who knew. So that kind of factored into the idea of having a hero who did a regular job but saw things that other people didn't see, heard things that other people didn't hear. And that all really came together with a real sense of a sort of shift in society over the last few years. You know, as an outsider, I feel sometimes that you see things through different eyes, and it seems to me that the mood in the country has really shifted a little bit recently. So the idea of having a hero who is prepared to stand up for the little guy, you know, rather than the 1%, or even as I was reading the other day, the 0.1% who owns more than the other 90%, you know, the idea that there's somebody out there who stands up for us rather than stands up for them, I think is pretty powerful.
You know, Andrew, I've always loved your British gift for understatement, but I thought you did that very well. It's certainly true that somebody doing not just a regular job, but what many people would consider a menial job, mm-hmm. or an invisible job, mm-hmm. People talk in front of them. You know, there's much in British literature about the servants who are just like wallpaper or pieces of furniture, you know, learn everything there is to know about the lives of their employers.
There is. That's a fascinating topic, that. It's something that Tasha comes across a lot with all the research she does for the Victorian era. And interestingly enough, it turns out that a lot of the time the servants actually preferred it when the aristocrats ignored them, because, you know, they had work to do. They had to clean that fireplace or bring that hot water, and if somebody started talking to them, then it just slowed them down and made their jobs even harder. So often there's a twist there that you know, sounds horrible and arrogant that they're being ignored, but turns out that they wanted to be ignored because they had so much work to do they couldn't afford to be standing around chatting.
Well, they also had mm-hmm. their own hierarchy to report to. For them, the mm-hmm. people that mattered were not so much the lord and the lady, but rather the housekeeper and the butler.
Exactly.
And whatever. So yeah. It wasn't that they didn't have a stratified yeah. kind of arrangement in people to report to. But I think what the most interesting part is not that they wanted to be ignored, but the other people in the room
yeah.
saw them really as just tools.
They did. They
or furniture. And
yeah.
so if you're going to send a guy who needs to get information mm-hmm. that he can't get by any sort of official mm-hmm. or direct means at the courthouse.
Yeah.
Your strategy instead is mm-hmm. to...
Yeah, is to go... You know, you have this role where you have complete access to the entire building. You can go anywhere, see anything, and yet no one pays you the slightest bit of attention.
That's because you're the janitor.
You're the janitor, yeah.
So it's almost like the Superman cloak of invisibility.
It is.
He just needs his mop and his bucket.
Yep, and he can go anywhere and do whatever he needs to do. Yeah.
Now, he starts out with a very specific mission in this book, which we won't go into for spoilers. But I do think that it was interesting the way you broadened it, so that at the end he sees that perhaps he can do good for others if he just stays in this role. However, doesn't that reasonably lead to him needing to have some sort of like outside income or something if he's, or is he going to just support himself on his wages as the janitor courthouse?
Yeah, that's a very good point, because you know, you do have to have a means to support yourself, especially if you're living in Manhattan like this guy is. But actually, that does get covered. He there's a plausible way that he gets to not only support himself, but to fund any kind of operations or missions or activities that he needs to undertake.
So. Well, that's right. So this is not really Nickel and Dimed in America by Barbara Ehrenreich, or the February big book called Made. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the guy who is working as a janitor, but he doesn't have to live.
Exactly.
As a janitor.
Yeah. If anything, it's more akin to the kind of Robin Hood legend, you know, where you have the, in all of those Robin Hood legends, it's, you know, Robin Hood is a fascinating thing, because when I grew up, I read the stories in England about, you know, the guy who lived in Sherwood Forest near Nottingham. So I assumed that that was the story. But then when you look into it, it turns out it's one of these archetypal legend stories where there's a version of it in almost every culture, you know, through Europe, Scandinavia. And in it, you always have the son of a nobleman who's a little bit wayward and reckless at the beginning, who goes off, normally it's some sort of military enterprise. And then when he comes back, expecting to pick up where he left off, turns out that his old life has disappeared, it's been taken away from him, he's disgraced in some way, he's pushed to the margins of society, and so has to redeem himself, you know, has to earn his status back by doing good deeds for others. And you know, in the legend I grew up with, it was living as a peasant in Sherwood Forest, so you know, perhaps this time round it's working as a janitor in New York.
I can't tell you how disappointed I was, and my gosh, it must have been in the 90s, my visit to Nottingham.
Uh-huh.
Where is Sherwood Forest, I ask you today?
Yeah, that's right. It's not really anywhere near Nottingham.
No, right? Nottingham was truly disappointing. I expected it to be romantic and legendary and part of a forest, and it's just this kind of grotty town with a not very good pub. Oh, well. The other thing I thought was interesting in your introduction, because this is the first book about this guy, so there's always a certain amount of setup that you have to do in order to let us know who this character is, that he has these unresolved and, in fact, a strange relationship with his father, and he arrives back to find that his father, in fact, is dead, and there isn't going to be the possibility of a reconciliation, which is what really casts him adrift in the way that you were just describing.
Yeah, that the fact that his, you know, he'd come back from his life in the army hoping to resolve matters with his father, and he can't because his father's dead. That sets him apart. But also the fact that in his backstory, he left home at 18 to join the army, and he was in the army his whole adult life up to this point. And coming out of the army, you know, it's a hard transition back into civilian life, because it's a life that he's never known before, and the rules are different. In fact, sometimes it turns out, it feels to him as if really there aren't any rules. And what I found when I was writing it was, you know, I had this picture in my head of him working as the janitor and getting involved with all his almost sort of vigilante type activities. But I realized you couldn't just have it, you know, go from A to B. He couldn't be army one day, vigilante the next. That wouldn't make any sense. I always have a kind of acid test myself when I'm reading a thriller, which is, if you could say to yourself, well, why didn't the hero just call the police? Then really the story has failed, because you have to, even if the events in the book and the emotional decisions are kind of big, large scale, quite exaggerated things, you still have to believe that that guy in that situation would do that thing. And if you think, well, no, he wouldn't, he'd have just picked up the phone and dialed 911, then the story falls apart. So I found that it was necessary to do a lot more to show the transition, his sort of evolution between the guy coming out of the army, a little naive, a little, you know, with rose-tinted spectacle view of what civilian life would be, finally realizing that sometimes there are problems that you've just got to solve yourself.
So. Well, I think that's very true, but you know, it's also true, as you said, he came back expecting to pick up the threads of his life as his father's son, and then that's blasted away by the fact that his father is dead and other things that happened. So when I read this, I am having an image, because I have been to stay with you in Tashad, Wyoming, of you in your office. So describe, for the people listening to us, describe your office and the really amazing furniture in it.
Yeah, my office, I've been a little bit self-indulgent, because for the 10 years we were living in Chicago, I had the corner of what used to be the maid's room, which sort of sandwiched between the kitchen and the laundry. So it was pretty hard to get any peace and quiet or any time on my own. So now I'm very lucky. I've got quite a large space on the lower level of our place in Wyoming, which it opens, it has windows on the left-hand side and the right-hand side, and then it has French doors which lead out onto a deck straight ahead with a basically uninterrupted view of a forest all the way down into Colorado.
Right.
And inside, I've indulged myself a little bit, because a store I really love, Restoration Hardware, does this range of furniture made out of, it's supposed to remind you of parts of aircraft. It's made out of pieces of aluminium screwed together in really kind of random cool ways. So I bought two desks made out of that, one regular style desk and one that looks like the wing of a plane, which I have right in the middle of the room. I have a couple of nice desk chairs. You know, it's difficult finding a chair that's comfortable to sit in all day long. So when I found one that I liked, I bought two. So I've got one for each desk. And then I've got bookshelves all around the walls. And then I've a bit of indulgence. My brother, for my 50th birthday, he bought me, he'd known that for decades I've been lusting after, you know, that iconic chaise by Courvoisier. You know, I've been lusting after those for years, but just couldn't justify it because they're stupidly expensive. So he bought me one of those for my birthday. So I can't remember that had arrived when you guys were there.
No, yeah, it hadn't. Yeah. And, you know, it's a good thing. I mean, how tall is Lee?
He's the same as me. He's 6'4".
Right. So yeah, he would sympathize. Yeah. But, you know, I think if you and your nice large room and your really oversized furniture, I'm 5'2", and so I look at your desk and I would think about working underneath it in the cubby hole, so to speak. Yeah. But yes, it does mm-hmm. look like an airplane. It's a really mm-hmm. dramatic office, whereas Tasha upstairs has got a much smaller a whole different room. I think it's wonderful that you each have a space that is so perfect for you.
Yeah, she went more of the kind of log cabin look. You know, her whole life she was a huge fan of the Little House books, and the whole, you know, as a kid she always used to dream of being a pioneer and coming west, so, and living in a log cabin. So she has her office done you know, much more in that kind of traditional log cabin style.
It's wonderful. Well, thank you for talking to me. We're going to go out and see what we can do to entertain readers who've come tonight to listen to you talk about Invisible.
Well, thank you so much, Barbara. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you.